We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show here on WILL. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Iran will rank high on many people's lists of threats to American security. The country's president, the current president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, rode to power on a wave of populism and brought with him an aggressive foreign policy, including a nuclear program. So here's the question. Does the United States have reason to fear Iran? This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will try to get a better understanding of Iranian politics since the revolution and see if that will help us also better understand the conflict and the tensions between the United States and Iran. And our guest for the program is Saeed Arjamand. He is a distinguished service professor of sociology and director of the Stony Brook Institute for Global Studies at Stony Brook University. He's also founder and president of the Association for the Study of Persianate Societies and the editor of the Journal of Persianate Studies. He is the author of a recently published book that we'll be talking about. The title is After Khomeini, Iran Under His Successors. It's a book that's published by the Oxford University Press. And while it does indeed talk something about the life of Imam Khomeini, it concentrates on what's happened in Iran and Iranian politics afterwards and some of the struggles over leadership and direction that have happened in this country. If, by the way, you're interested in reading about the Iranian Revolution, you might look at a previous book that our guest has authored. The Turban for the Crown is the title of that, also published by Oxford, and I'm sure that you can find that book as well. Here on our program, if you're interested in joining the conversation, you can do that one of two ways. You can call the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Professor Arjamand, hello.
Oh, hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
We appreciate it. I think that there is one very important idea here that you write about, and it's the place, I suppose, that we should begin. And that is with the idea that, despite what some people might think, that the Iranian revolution is ongoing. It is a work in progress. It didn't end when Imam Khomeini died. It didn't end later. It's still going.
Yes. Now, I thought that was a point that wasn't generally appreciated either in the policy circles or in the public in general. And indeed, coming to power of Ahmadinejad took many people by surprise in 2005 for this reason, that everyone had assumed, indeed, that the revolution was over. But revolutions have a dynamics of their own, indeed, and they do tend to go on beyond this coming to power of the moderates, which was what ended the French Revolution, and that's what's really stayed in everyone's mind, that you have the radicals, and you have the moderates, then the radicals, and the return of the so-called moderates, and the revolution is over. And that's what I tried to show, that really was not the case in many revolutions, and certainly not in Iran. And Ahmadinejad came into power, really, on a platform of loyalism to the revolution and keeping it alive. Mm-hmm. And I think the aggressive foreign policy that you do mention is an aspect of it.
I think that you make a point, and I noted down particularly some of your words here that I really liked. I liked the turn of phrase, because you at one point write in the book about how a lot of people think of the revolutionary process as, in your words, a sudden convulsion in the body politic, like a passing fever that breaks with a return to normalcy. And your point is that, in fact, most revolutions are not like that. Maybe you might talk just a little bit about how First of all, how the Iranian revolution fits the pattern of great revolutions that have come before.
Yes. Well, as I think I just said, I think it doesn't really fit the pattern of the French Revolution, but nor do the other big revolutions. My favorite parallel that I draw in the book is, in fact, with the Bolshevik Revolution, where there's kind of an uncanny similarity of a 30-year gap between the unexpected comeback of the hardliners to replace moderates who had been in power for quite a while and made everyone assume that the revolution was over. And I make the point that, in fact, Ahmadinejad, the distance between Ahmadinejad and Khomeini in the beginning of the revolution is 30 years, and the distance between the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 and the big, huge post-war expansion, export of Marxism, Leninism to Asia and other parts of the world is also exactly 30 years. So this is, this is obviously a coincidence, but it, I think it shows how it does fit a distinct revolutionary pattern, that the hardliners don't really disappear. And my point is that, of course, at the beginning of the revolution, everyone is a revolutionary and a radical, but then people change their positions quite radically, some of them, including the reformists in Iran, who did really make very significant changes in their outlook. But then there's a group that remains, hardens its position, if anything, and that group is, it should not be discounted. It does have a distinct chance to come back in many revolutions, including Iran. And the rise of Ahmadinejad and the Revolutionary Guards really, to my mind, can be explained in that way.
Our guest, maybe just a very quickly reintroduce, our guest for this hour is Saeed Arjamand. He is a professor of sociology and director of the Stony Brook Institute for Global Studies at Stony Brook University and has written a lot about the politics of Iran. His earlier book, The Turban for the Crown, was about a more thorough treatment of the Iranian Revolution. And then his current book, which is titled After Khomeini, Iran Under His Successors, really looks at what has happened since, pretty much concentrating on this period following the death of Ayatollah Khomeini and struggles for power afterwards, and the kind of thing that we have seen here with the successive chapters of people who were considered to be more moderates or reformers, and then with the return of the hardliners with the election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We could spend a lot of time, I'm sure, talking about the life of the Ayatollah Khomeini and his significance to Iran. If we could just try to narrow it down, though, if I ask this question, what did he consider to be or thought should be the central principle or set of principles for governing the country? What would that be?
Well, this is, of course, the most contested issue, especially since the June election of last year, 2009, that was that the opposition, I think, rightly considers a big fraud, as the results were announced before the votes could possibly have been counted. But the reason why I think it's a difficult issue, and in a way it's you can't really read the mind of Khomeini, who's been dead for 20 years. Each of us will say what he really thought was should have been the form of government and so forth. The fact is that, of course, when he talked about the Islamic government and this theory of what I call the mandate of the jurist, the velayat al-faqih, or the mandate of the jurist to rule on behalf of the hidden imam of the Shiites, he was extremely vague when he put that idea forward in 1970-71 in exile in Najaf. And he never really developed it. Indeed, during the revolution, he advised his followers not to raise the issue at all because he obviously wanted to have as many people rally behind him as possible, including the including Democrats and other leftist oppositions, the Shah, opposition to the Shah. And for that reason, in fact, he did forbid, even that far as forbidding discussion of his idea during the first months of the revolution. And indeed, the puzzle is that at some point he agreed to a proposed draft constitution produced by the Bazargan, the Liberal Nationalist Provisional Prime Minister, which really didn't have any of the features of this of the current constitution, and he supposedly endorsed it and quickly wanted to put it into effect in the early months, probably because of the uncertainties and his feeling insecure. But then, during the summer of the first summer after the revolution of 1979, he seems to change his mind. He thought that the leftists were hijacking the constitution, and he thought he had bad memories from Iran's previous revolution in 1906, the constitutional revolution, where the clergy actually did bring out the masses, but then the intellectuals got the better of them, and so he didn't want that repeated. So at that point, then he instructed his two trusted lieutenants, Ayatollahs Montazeri and Beheshti, to actually rewrite the constitution. And at that point, then, it's still not clear what he exactly had in mind. What the clerics and the hardliners behind Ayatollah Khamenei say is that he wanted pure theocracy, the layat dari, or mandate of the jurist, and strict observance of Shiite law and so forth. Mm-hmm. The reformers, led by Khatami, and I think for former President Khatami, former President Hashemi Rafsanjani joined them sometime, or he shifts in and out, but certainly the candidates, Mousavi and Karoubi, they argue that indeed, and a lot of the children of the revolution of turned reformists argue that in fact Khomeini stressed the popular vote and acceptance of government by the people, and so they think that what they call republicanism, the republican feature of the regime, was primary in Khomeini's mind. The clerics and Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme jurists, they know that is not the case, and it was the clericalism that was primary in his mind. There is a third element of the popularly elected councils, etc., that Khatami finally put into practice after 20 years, but that's a subsidiary of the of popular government. So who exactly knows what Khomeini had in mind primarily? It's clearly that both things were important to him.
So
he certainly did not want too much concentration of power. He had been against the Pahlavi dictatorship for too long. On the other hand, he certainly was not an unqualified Democrat in any way.
Yeah, so the kind of political turmoil struggle that's been going on since he died, it seems to be in large part due to the fact that he never really said in a clear way what the direction should be.
That's right. Because he never clarified that completely or even partially. There's this constant struggle over his heritage, and both sides can claim that they represent the true Khomeini, the true heritage of Khomeini. Mm. You cannot really prove or disprove it, because he certainly said a lot of things, and you can find support for both positions by quoting Khomeini. And the other thing that is really basically the most important thing is that he didn't know, probably. That's why, because what he'd written down in exile really was not a constitutional program. And he wanted this, he wanted that. He didn't want to be too imitative of Western democracy. On the other hand, he wouldn't. His support came from the people, and he was a populist. But he never really had time, and he wasn't a constitutional lawyer, and he had a very ad hoc approach. And in fact, that went on for 10 years, and just before he died in 1989, he revised the Constitution. He ordered revision of Constitution that was done after his death, but along the lines that he suggested. That was because he was still tinkering and trying to change things. And much of some of it was done, of course, some of the important details was decided after his death, so it was obviously beyond his control. Mm. Things like the empowering of the Council of Guardians and this other assembly of leadership experts, but many of it. But basically, I think the politics of Iran has really been dominated by his long shadows in the past 20 years since his death.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly, he seems to have set up the conditions for conflict shortly before he died, when he divided his power between two people who seemed to represent two different schools of thought. On the one hand, the Ayatollah Khamenei, who had been president and then became the supreme leader, on the one hand, and Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, who was one of the more moderate reformers, on the other. It seems to me that in doing that, he set the stage for conflict.
Well, that's partly true, but it's also true that the difference between these two figures became greatly enhanced as a result of their positions. Mm. They found themselves in positions with opposite interests, so they kind of got moved further and further away from each other. Way back when Khomeini picked the two, they seemed much more similar than they do now, 20 years later, because as a result of 20 years of power struggle, they've really drifted apart. And the reason for that is that really the president's position in the Constitution and the leader's position in the Constitution are not, they can't possibly go smoothly together. And so, in fact, in a way, they were pushed in different directions by the positions they held in Khomeini's regime. As I said, Khomeini hadn't really had a definitive design, so he did a bit of that. He wanted to keep both offices in place, clearly. Mm-hmm. But he really hadn't thought out the implications and the possible tension among the two.
Let us talk with some callers. We have some people here to bring into the conversation, starting with someone here where we are, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. In the election cycle, it seems to me one of the things that's untalked about, I personally think that Akhmedinov probably tried to steal the election, but I think he already won it. And I think one of the things that actually happened was result of the Bush administration's destabilization campaign, with PJAC on the Iraqi border and Jandala, who were basically acting as our fundamentalists on the Pakistani border. There was a mosque bombing just like maybe a week before the election, and that would certainly concentrate the mind and promote a conservative vote, it seems to me. So I think that's always unacknowledged, it seems, in contemporary. But going back to the time of the revolution, you mentioned this worry about a constitutional takeover from the left. Bani Sadra has a lot to say about this, and sometimes people say that his defense of the October surprise thesis sort of disqualifies him. But you have a writer like Robert Dreyfus, American writer, who wrote The Devil's Game, which talks about the whole way that the U.S. foreign policy through Middle East and South Asia supported fundamentalists against leftists, basically, and more egalitarian groups. And he, I think, asserts that that's even true in Iran. And basically, it's more blowback. It's more of a political dimension. It's not like Afghanistan, where. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I don't know how you'll react to it, but it's an interesting line of discourse that never gets treated, it seems to me.
Yes. I think that is, you're raising a very, very important question, and one that's very difficult to answer. On the late thing, I think nothing the Bush administration did was helpful. Their greatest mistakes, I think, was to subvert the nuclear deal that the Europeans had worked out with Iran before Ahmadinejad came into power, and it was wrecked just by President Bush and his advisors, and that would have solved the nuclear, or at least for quite a while, nuclear problem under Khatami and for quite a while that would have happened. The other thing, even going further back, I point out that there were a lot of missed opportunities during Hashemi Rafsanjani's tenure as president in the early 1991 to 1995. Of course, this period is also the period of the Hoover bombings, the Buenos Aires thing, and the bombing of the Jewish center there. Now, so it looks as if the evidence is not clear, but in fact, my explanation is that if you look at Iran as a revolutionary regime, you see that it's clear, because all revolutionary regimes have these fifth columns, people, loose cannons who do things, and I explained that in one chapter, and there was a lot of attempt to wreck Hashemi Rafsanjani's attempt to make up with the U.S., by doing this, by murder of Bakhtiar at critical moments. But the U.S. never responded to Hashemi Rafsanjani, which might have enabled them to clamp down on the hardliners and then change radically the policy as he clearly wanted after the first Iraq war with the idea, James Baker's idea of the New World Order. Now, you even want to go further back to Benny Sadr and the October Surprise. I think there again, it's a story of missed opportunities. But as far as the 80s are concerned, I really think it was too early to expect a rational U.S. policy, because the memory of the hostages were too alive, and the whole generation that was deeply hurt was not going to make any gestures towards Iran. But in the 1990s, I think, you would have thought that the chance did arise, and the Iran Hashemi Rafsanjani did really make the first important steps that were not answered. And then, of course, after the invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001, then Iranians made really a real serious effort that was turned down by the Bush administration and responded by the regime change policy. So I think this is a roundabout way of answering your question, or at least addressing some of the issues. But basically, I think I agree with you.
Well, I have another caller here I need to get to. We're already at our midpoint. Our guest is Saeed Arjamand. He is a distinguished service professor of sociology and director of the Stony Brook Institute for Global Studies at Stony Brook University in New York. He is the author of the book The Turban for the Crown, which is a look at history of the Iranian Revolution, and then a new book that's just out that picks up where that book ended and goes forward to where we are now. This book is titled After Khomeini, Iran Under His Successors. Both books are published by the Oxford University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Up next, another caller here, someone in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about, or a lot about, the role of women in Iran currently, the treatment of women. We have the example of the Nobel Prize-winning jurist, but also, I mean, it's especially pertinent given that I just read that Iran has now been put on the UN Commission for the Rights of Women. I might have the name of that commission wrong, but which to me seems outrageous and beyond belief that given the way women are treated in Iran. So I'll hang up and let you talk about that. Thank you.
All right.
Yes. Well, that is another, of course, key issue. And nobody could have failed to see the salience, the prominence of women in the protest movement of the 6 months following the June 2009 electoral putsch. They were there, leading elements in all the demonstrations. Women wearing green, indeed, were the ones who gave the movement its name, the Green Movement. And they were very prominent. Incidentally, we know that they're prominent among Mousavi's supporters because his wife campaigned with him for the first time. His wife, Zahra Rahnavert, who's a university president, president of Women's University. And she was very important in bringing out not only women, but also the younger generation in support of her husband and the reformists. But it's also, I should say, that women were also very prominent among the campaigners and the proposed cabinet of the other reformist candidate, the clerical one, Mehdi, Hojjat al-Islam Mehdi Karoubi. Now, both Karoubi and Mousavi certainly relied on some very competent women in their campaigns. And I think you are right to mention Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Prize winner, and her valiant efforts to defend human rights. Women basically became prominent right away after the revolution, of course, when the participation of different people was allowed. If you go to kind of the structural considerations, I suppose you could say that before, by the time of the revolution, about 13% of women were in the labor force, and 13% of labor force consisted of women. This thing dropped to about 8% in the first decade under Khomeini, when Khomeini basically said, good, you came and demonstrated, revolution won, now go back to the kitchen. But women actually did not go back to the kitchen. They resisted, they remained prominent despite enormous difficulties in the public sphere. And now the employment figures are, by the way, just about back to, or a little, just about a little higher than the time of the revolution. We're back to 14-15% of the labor force being female. But that's really only a part of the story. If you look at the university students, you have the majority. 55% or more of the students at the universities and institutions of higher learning are now women. So you can see the enormous frustration if 55% have higher degrees and only 15% of the women can have entry, have jobs, be in the labor force. You can see the enormous frustration that obviously the gap between the two, and that certainly accounts for their prominence in the reform movement and in the last elections and the post-election election demonstrations. I think even Ahmadinejad has recognized this. Of course, he has his own women supporters, tokenism or whatever you want to call it, that he does emphasize. He tried to get to say that women should be allowed to watch football and the sports and so forth, and to the displeasure of the clerics. And so he, I think they've become too important to be ignored, even by this hardliner government. However, there is, of course, constant pressure, harassment, imprisonment of the women's leaders, and the I think the advances that they had made, the women's NGOs under Khatami during the reform movement from 1995 to 2005, many of them did get registered. Many women's NGOs came into being. Those are being have come under a lot of pressure, especially the government argues that these NGOs, if they do anything political, they have kind of lost their civic status as a civic association. She tries to close as many of them as possible. Shirin Ebadi is under tremendous pressure. So I think this is the women, but I think that is really the greatest challenge to the regime. I can't see any way that Ahmadinejad can send women back to the kitchen any more than Khomeini could.
All right. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Saeed Arjamand. He is a sociologist and director of Stony Brook Institute for Global Studies at Stony Brook University in New York. We're talking about Iran. He has authored a book about the revolution, The Turban for the Crown, and the more recent book, which takes up from where that book, the first book, ended and takes us to where we are now. This book is titled After Khomeini, Iran Under His Successors. Both books are published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are certainly welcome. I think we have somebody else here ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Another caller here, line one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
Except for thinking it's really complex, I don't really have a very good grasp of what's happening in Iran. And I was wondering if maybe, this might be an awkward way of phrasing the question, but maybe you'd answer it. There's an idea that government's legitimacy ultimately rests on its sole control of violence or physical control. In Iran, what part of society provides this force now, or and then the Revolutionary Guard or another, or perhaps what two or more entities exist that might attain this dominance? And then I wonder if I could just toss in a quotation, because I thought the source was interesting. Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. It was by John F. Kennedy. So I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
All right. Well, I think with the first part, your first question, I would say any regime is maintained in power by effective force. I wouldn't say its legitimacy comes from that. I think the hardliners who have been rising, that is the Revolutionary Guards and Ahmadinejad and people largely from the military intelligence personnel of the regime, have proven that they have the power. They clearly have the military power. They do have this siege or mobilization corps that they've used very effectively to put down the protests and demonstrations that followed for 6 months or more after the June elections. So I would say that that's the power on which the Iranian regime rests. But I would not say that that means that its legitimacy is not challenged. One of the problems with the rise of Revolutionary Guards is that it's been at the expense of the clerical elite in Iran. That, of course, and the legitimacy of the regime officially rests on this clericalist theory that the supreme jurist, called the leader, in fact, has the enormous power that he does wield in Iran. Now, effectively, we do know that the supreme leader's power is due to his, so far, his ability to control the Revolutionary Guards, all of whom are still are and act as his men because he's promoted them. It's not clear for how long that will continue, but this seems to be the case. But the result of this has been that, of course, the clerical elite, most notably former President Hashemi Rafsanjani and Khatami, have been alienated. They don't like Ahmadinejad, and they don't like the Revolutionary Guards. And they still have powerful constitutional means. There is this assembly of constitutional experts that, in theory, could dismiss the supreme jurist, the leader. There is the expediency council and so forth. But, of course, I'm not saying that the clerical elite has all turned against the supreme leader. Of course, they're still with him, the majority, and many of them are conservatives and hardline supporters of him. But a very significant portion of that elite has split off, including some few grand ayatollahs. Now, I raise this because that's really relevant to the issue of the legitimacy of the regime. Of course, in the eyes of the protesters, the regime doesn't have legitimacy because they said that it ignores the democratic features of the constitution that were essential, they claim, to Khomeini's design. Some, of course, many of the protesters may want to have all references to Islam excluded. That's including the former foreign minister and the man who leads the Iran Liberation Movement after the first provisional prime minister, Bazargan, namely Dr. Ebrahim Yazdi, who for some time has been saying we want the constitution minus the mandate of the jurist and then all the clerical aspects deleted from it. The exiles, Akbar Ganji and others, have certainly since 2002 have been saying that we should have a purely democratic constitution. So there has been a growing challenge to the legitimacy of the regime on democratic grounds for the past 10 decades. But since last June, you have a new phenomenon that is growing, namely challenging the legitimacy of the regime from the clerical side by some of the important clerics who do say that they follow the late Ayatollah Montazeri, saying that this idea mandate of the clergy should be totally reinterpreted in a way that it doesn't interfere with democracy and democratic government at all. So while I would say, just to go back to your questions, the legitimacy of the regime is seriously challenged since last June. The effective force behind it prevails so far in the form of Revolutionary Guards. Now, this leads to your second question, is the change going to be peaceful or violent? That is very hard to answer. Demonstrators, I call them the Green Movement, has been a movement for civil disobedience. They say we don't want another revolution, we do not want a violent way of changing it. And that still seems to be the dominant position in the opposition, although, of course, as time goes on and civil disobedience doesn't prove able to effective, or at any rate able to dislodge the regime, you could easily imagine that people who say violence is the only means, the number would increase.
If I'm afraid that this maybe is taking a step back, chronologically speaking, but I wanted you maybe to talk a little bit about what was happening in 2005 when Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was elected the first time. As you've said, and I think a lot of people remember, his election for a lot of people outside of Iran was a surprise.
Yeah.
And earlier we talked about the fact that it's possible that support for him might have actually been helped by what the United States had been doing and the fact that the United States was putting pressure on Iran. But if you just talked about what was going on internally in Iran at that time, how could that explain his election?
Yeah, I think that's very important, because this question really points to the great weakness of the reform movement led by former President Khatami. It's clear that in 2009, Ahmadinejad and his supporters cheated. But in 2005, there was real support for him. There's still probably there was cheating in that election too, because the Bastille, the Revolutionary Demobilization Corps, was very active in promoting Ahmadinejad, and in the first round, it looks very much as if Karoubi had in fact won and got the second place against Hashemi Rafsanjani. And they obviously helped Ahmadinejad. They cheated enough so that by a few hundred thousand, and they put him second. In the second round, of course, he beat. There was no doubt the margin was so great that Ahmadinejad did beat Hashemi Rafsanjani in the second round of the 2005 presidential elections. So, in short, there was cheating then, but there was also considerable support for Ahmadinejad. And in the book, I suggest that this is the one thing that we all missed. And the reformists especially, they were weakening. They were not fighting back the conservatives. And that led to widespread popular disillusionment with the reform movement, not just in 2005, but even way back in 2003. The first sign came in these municipal council elections. Ahmadinejad, in fact, became mayor of Tehran because most people actually didn't vote. Some 12 or 15 percent of the population turned up to vote in that election, and they all voted for hardliners. So the reformer supporters certainly stayed home. The following 2004 majlis, parliamentary national elections, same thing. The reformers did badly. And the reason I suggested was that the reformers really were not good fighters. In fact, I don't know how else to put it. They were good talkers, and they were hoping that they would talk and things will get changed. They grossly underestimated the opposition of the hardliners and their determination. And once that became clear, they were not willing to fight constitutionally and extra-constitutionally. And so that kind of led to people's general disillusionment with the reformists. And they did vote in Ahmadinejad, as I said, not... not with a majority vote in the first round, but they did in the second round of parliamentary elections. So mm-hmm. I think what we do need to consider is really and I try to do that in the book, really the weaknesses of the reform movement. That should not be discounted. If we are to learn lessons from the past, we should study that seriously and hopefully next round they won't repeat that when they have a chance.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Saeed Arjomand. He is a Distinguished Service Professor of Sociology and Director of the Stony Brook Institute for Global Studies at Stony Brook University in New York. He's the author of the book The Turban for the Crown, about the Iranian Revolution, and more recently, After Khomeini, Iran Under His Successors, which takes a look at what has been happening in Iranian politics pretty much since the death of the Ayatollah Khomeini and bringing it up to where we are now. Both of his books are published by the Oxford University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. A little earlier in the conversation, in response to a question from the caller, you talked about the influence of women in Iranian politics and about them being a powerful force. I wonder if generally you could say something about generational divides in Iran's politics and how particularly growing numbers of younger people who may be more reform-minded than their parents or grandparents might be important as we go forward.
Yes. I think the generational thing, like women, of course, half of the younger generation are women, so there's quite an overlap between the young people and women. But young men and women generally, I think, in this generation, people whom we've seen demonstrate since last June in the streets, there's no mistake about their ages. I mean, you do have some older people do participate, but predominantly it's a young movement, the protest movement. Generation, I think there are two generational considerations. Of course, one is the generation who are opposed, and I would say that most of the younger generation are much less interested in Islam than the generation of Musavi, Khatami, and these graying Islamic reformers in their 60s and 70s. And I think there are two generational aspects to the revolution. One is the generation that comes after, but more clearly there's also a generation that makes the revolution and stays in power until basically it dies out. If you think of, again, the parallel with the Soviet revolution, one of the reasons for Gorbachev and the reform movement and whatever the collapse of communism was that the old Politburo died. They're all falling asleep, men in their late 80s, as they're including the president Andropov and the people who followed him. And the younger generation really had to come in with new ideas. Now, in the Iranian case, it's the same. The youngest revolutionaries are people like Mousavi and Khatami, who are pushing 70. Karoubi and Hashemi Rafsanjani are in their mid-70s and so forth. Now, there is a gap. I consider all those people the children of revolution, including the reformists, who turned from their original radical position into genuinely reformist, democratic, civil society advocacy positions. And they were incidentally predominantly male. There are not that many women among them. The women's movement, I think, in fact, even women of the older generation naturally gravitated towards the youth, university students who've been active since 1999. And since 1999, there really was the first beginning of a gap between the reformist elite, that is the reigning children of the revolution, and the new generation of students and youth. In 1999, remember, there were some violent incidents at the University of Tehran, and Khatami and the reformists generally didn't really support the students. And I take 1999 as the point of where the students really seem to be disillusioned with the reformists as much as anyone else, as much as people who voted in 2003 and 2004 and 2005 against the reformists. Now, what was really remarkable and completely surprising, at least to me, was the enormous success, and in the last month, really, of the two reformist candidates, especially Mousavi and his wife, Zahra Rahnavard, in mobilizing the reformers, in bringing the students to their camp once more and say, let's make a last effort. Let's have an alliance between the reformists among the former revolutionary elite, radical elite, formerly radical revolutionary elite. Let's have a alliance between them and the new generation. And I think what's really sad about the suppression of the movement is that, in fact, that was the last chance I see for the reformists to have prevailed with the strong, vigorous support from the younger generation. That having failed, I see the younger generation drifting further and further away to other forms of opposition and losing their interest in graying old Islamic elite, which is reformist, but which is proving to be ineffective and really no match for the brutal force of the Revolutionary Guards and their abuse of courts and so forth.
Well, that I suppose that it gets back to the in an earlier point we were talking about the possibility for change and whether that might be peaceful or violent. If what we're seeing is a kind of erosion of a middle ground, and the distance between the hardliners and particularly younger people who are interested in political change, if that gap between the two widens and there's nobody in the middle, that makes one wonder whether, in fact, a peaceful transition would be possible.
That's exactly, the most worrying aspect of the situation. I think the erosion of the middle ground is very real. And so I do see this polarization as fairly inevitable.
We're just about at the point that we have to finish, and you know, my apologies, I have a caller that we just can't take. In about a minute, can you say something about what you think would be the policy of the United States, maybe could be, should be, that would be more constructive than what we have done in the past?
Well, I think what the Obama administration started doing is certainly the right move, talking and stopping the regime change, and certainly going back to the policy, the so-called people-to-people, the cultural approach policy that Madeleine Albright and the former President Clinton proposed on the very last year of their administration. So I think that's already the right move. However, I would say don't expect anything too soon, and do not. Sometimes we're too impatient asking for quick results. I think it would be a mistake to make any concessions to the Ahmadinejad government. There should be symbolic campaigns against them. We should say we're willing to talk, as I said, but you're still holding your fist and not clenching it. I would say is, I think, patience, continuation of the present policy without much expectation and without any concessions. Regime, certainly no concessions at the expense of human rights, and waiting for some distant future for things to change.
All right, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Saeed Arjumand, is professor of sociology at Stony Brook University in New York. Professor Arjumand, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
There we will pause, as we usually do at this point, so we can bring you an update on the market. Stay tuned.